Good evening and welcome. My name is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and we are here tonight for the second Rounds with Dr. Rita Marie call as part of the Insulin Resistance Practitioner Training. These are less formal calls than are the main calls for the B4 Be Gone program, and the purpose of these calls is to give you a little bit of the background behind some of the pieces that we're going over in the various B4 Be Gone modules, and more to answer your questions, to give you ideas on how you can present this material to your patients or clients, either one-on-one in small groups. The other thing I like to do on these calls is actually do some case studies. And I've got a couple of glucose forms, tracking forms, that were submitted by a couple of our practitioner members. And I also have one or two that we haven't gone over yet that were submitted by our client members. And we'll go over those. This is our second rounds call, and these are where we can get in together with other practitioners and with me and get the behind the scenes. I always, at the beginning of every presentation, make sure that I extend the knowledge, the disclaimer, that the information that we're presenting isn't intended to replace a doctor one-on-one practitioner relationship. It's not medical advice. It's a sharing of knowledge and information. So from my experience, my research to yours, and I always encourage you to do research of your own and make your decision based on what makes sense to you. And when you're working with people who are maybe on medications, we have several people in the B4 Be Gone program right now who are on insulin, and some of them are on metformin and other glucose-lowering medications, is to warn them that your need for medication might indeed go down during the program, and to make sure that your prescribing doctor knows about what you're doing so that you can be in touch and get your doses dropped accordingly if need be. We actually had one of our participants the other night on the call who started out with her blood sugars ranging from 300 to 500, and she's diabetic on insulin and metformin, and she was on 10 units of insulin 3 times a day plus metformin, and now her blood sugars are between 110 and 140, I think she said, and she's down to only between 5 and 10, actually not even 10, I think she said 5 units of insulin once a day, and she's cut her metformin dose as well. So really cool stuff, but if she's working with her doctor and she's really aware and constantly monitoring. But if you get somebody who's on medication and they're kind of not in the loop and not testing very much, they could end up in with those diabetic, you know, hypoglycemic coma kind of thing. So you have to make sure that you make these people aware that you're not replacing their qualified medical doctor, unless you are a medical doctor and you're getting them off it yourself. So the agenda tonight, a little bit of connection. We kind of did that a little bit right at the beginning, and we'll have more connection towards the end. I want to just do a few highlights of Module 3, which was about stress. I called it Harmonizing Your Head and Your Heart, and a few of the highlights on Module 4, which we're right in the process of now. And for each of these modules, I just want to just kind of go over with you what the different activities I've included in there are and kind of the rationale for what was included in the order that it was put in there. And you can give and take and use some or not some of this stuff, this flow, if you're working with somebody one-on-one. It's much more fluid when you're working with somebody one-on-one. You don't have to go in a specific order, but obviously if you're teaching a class, you have to do it in a specific order. And then we're going to go over what to expect on the virtual seminar day, which is on the 21st. So if you haven't already marked your calendar for that, go ahead and do that. So the program was laid out with 6 modules, 5 main content modules, going over each one, going over each of the main lifestyle changes that people are being asked to make to get their blood sugars in balance and harmonize their bodies and get rid of the brain fog and all that. And then the last module is stepping into your future, and I actually divided that into 2 parts. The first one being, hey, what do you do now? How do you figure out what supplements you still need? What kind of dietary changes should you keep going on? How do you know if you can start to introduce some of the foods that used to make your sugar spike? Lots of that. And then the second part, we'll go over a little bit more of that, and then a lot more time for Q&A, because that's what people really need, is leaving a program. You'll find that, I'm sure you do, when you work one-on-one with people, that they do really great when you're holding their hand, and then you say, oh, you know, we're ready to not see you for another month and come back in a month and all hell breaks loose and they're back on their old habits. And when you don't have that accountability and somebody that's looking after you and that is asking you how you're doing and guiding you to what the next step is, then sometimes you fall apart. And that's why I want to make sure that people really have what they need moving forward. And so the highlights of Module 3, that was last week's module, is we went over a lot about stress and how it actually affects your health and your weight, and we talked a little bit about cortisol and DHEA and insulin and the relationships between that a little bit. We did more of that in Module 4, and there's still more to come. I have a very detailed handout that's going to be coming out tomorrow, I think, on Module 4, that really goes into depth on the hormones. And then why setting goals and connecting to your vision is so important to your health. I find that people who just kind of lollygag around and don't really have a goal, and when the choice comes up between chocolate cake and their salad or their really good low glycemic meal that they've been become accustomed to take, going by overhead, what happens is if they're not really firmly rooted to that outcome, then they don't continue to follow through. So it's really your job as a coach to just keep them motivated and inspired to be moving towards that outcome. I spoke to a woman today, I've been coaching with her for about, 5 or 6 weeks, and she was, a little disappointed that she'd only lost 9.5 pounds so far. And, over the last 3 years, she hadn't lost any weight. So it's really important to be keeping encouraging people that that's good and that that kind of weight reduction is more profound because it tends to be the slow and steady tends to stick more. But then she was talking about how she's been off gluten ever since day one when I told her she needed to go off gluten. And she kind of knew it before that, but having me holding her hand and speaking with her once a week made a real big difference. But she said, I don't even miss the gluten. She said, sometimes when my husband comes home with pizza, the smell, I go, oh, that smells really good. But she says, I would just not put that in my body anymore. I'm done with it, because when I realized what it was doing to me and how much better I feel without it. And then when I listened to the radio show that you did with Dr. O'Brien, she said, I don't want any of that stuff happening in my body. I want it gone. So sometimes people ask me, other colleagues of mine ask me, well, why do you tell people so much detail? People don't want to know the detail about how these hormones work in their body. Just tell them what to do. And what I've found is that it's much more effective to share with people what's happening in their body, because then they have this visual, then they have this ability to think it through. When they're about to make a decision, it comes to mind, ooh, I saw that inside of that way that artery looked, and I see the way that spike of glucose is affecting my weight, and I see, et cetera, et cetera. So I really like to give that. When you're working one-on-one with people, and when I am too, I'm much more conscious of what they can handle and what they need, and I may not be giving them as much of the detail as I would be in a group program. And because I've got the group program and the materials built up, then when I'm speaking to somebody one-on-one and I feel like, wow, they need more, I go, okay, go on to this side and open up this, and then you can, you can learn a little bit more about the background of how that works and give it to them in the doses that they can accept. When I first started out in practice, I just figured everybody wanted to know everything, and they were like me. They were just, wow, their eyes were open, and finally they saw what all this stuff was doing, and they wanted more and more. Well, I realized everybody isn't like me in that, and I know a lot of you guys are, and that's why you're on the other end of the seat from people, as instead of, on the receiving end, you're actually doing and working with people because you did want to know more, and you did want to delve in. But not everybody wants to do that. And I would send people away literally the first day with this binder full of handouts and say, okay, I want you to read this and this and this and this and this. And it was just so overwhelming that half the people, most of the people didn't read it all. So I've learned to divvy it out small, but I still have a tendency to just give a lot of information. But with the internet, you can actually send them to places and they don't have to keep going through it. It's not like a big binder sitting on their bench and they don't know where to start with it. So, and then the stress transformation breaks, that's all the work from HeartMath, a slight variation that I do with it, but pretty much it's the HeartMath with coherence. And when we encourage people to take those in 1 to 2 minute intervals throughout the day, it does amazing things for keeping those cortisol levels under control and keeping you from constantly, burning up muscle to make fat, as I tell people. You burn up the muscle, it goes into your blood, you don't run away from a tiger, you're sitting at your desk, so it gets stored back away as belly fat. So I remember speaking to somebody a few months back who said, you know, I don't feel like I've gained any weight, but it's like my thigh muscles are turning into belly fat. It's just like I've shifted. And you know, we of course can do things to help that, and stress is a big piece. So that's why we include that as part of this. And then the positive attributes, I can't stress that enough when you're working with people, to really keep them focused on what they're doing right, because it's really easy to have them come in with their diet diary and it's totally not what you asked them to do, and they didn't take the supplements, they haven't been exercising, and you just want to just put your head in your hands and say, what the heck's going on? But instead, you look for what's positive, and that lifts you up, and it lifts them up as well. Wow, I see that every day you're taking a stress break right before each meal. That's awesome, you know. And maybe that they just ate Twinkies, but at least you're pointing out the good stuff. And people need to know that. And that book that I had in there, that little process that I put in the program, it's really important for people to really focus in on what's positive, because it's really easy to just get to be in that perfectionistic mode, which creates stress, which, you know, imbalances your cortisol, messes up your insulin, creates insulin resistance, and there you go. And then, of course, I included an emotional eating strategy, and you may have emotional eating strategies of your own. Maybe you're a specialist in that. Maybe you have a lot of experience with that. But so many people, you can give them all the great steps to do, but they're not going to do it because they're emotionally tied with their food. So you really need to hone them in on developing their own emotional eating strategy. I remember when I first taught this to one of my patients on a group call. I think that was a very small group program, very intimate group. I think we had 6 or 8 people on it. And she basically shared that it was pretty amazing when she created this emotional eating strategy, which was, she had an index card, and on one side was a picture of the things she would normally do, the bread or whatever that she would normally reach for, and then the words describing how she felt when she ate that. And she felt depressed, and she felt like her thyroid nodules were increasing and all. And then she had on the other side what she could do differently, and she found that at work, where a lot of her temptations were happening because people brought in the cookies or whatever. So at work, what she would do is she'd have this big bag of tangerines, and she'd bring a bag of tangerines and stick them in a bowl. And so on the other side was this juicy, open tangerine, and all the words that described how she felt when she stuck to her diet. And that really helped her. So helping your people create their own emotional eating strategies, really, really, really important. And then, let's see, what else? Fun. Fun in your daily routine. You would think that I was pulling teeth the way that people react when I ask them to sit down and write 10 things that you feel like are fun. It seems to be so difficult for people. They just can't seem to do it. Like they're so divorced from fun because they've been in this work mode and worry mode, that when you ask them to sit down and write, they're like, oh, I don't know, this is really hard. It's really important to build in fun, even if it's just 5 minutes, of looking at pretty pictures or looking at a slideshow or putting your hands in clay, which is what I love to do, and molding something or taking up a paintbrush or doing a crossword puzzle. It's really important for you as a practitioner, because you can get so caught up with taking care of other people, but also for them. It's important. I had one person who she loved playing the piano. I don't have time, and I miss it, and she's just all running out. No, I don't have time for fun. I said, where's the piano? It's outside, you know, right near the dining room. Okay, can you, on your way to the kitchen, before you go in to make food every night, can you just sit down and play 5 minutes? Is there anything you can play on the piano in 5 minutes? She goes, well, sure, there's this or this. I said, okay, pull out that music, put it on the piano, and when you walk by, you sit down and you play for 5 minutes. And she loved it. She said it just made such a big difference in her day. And that's going to make a difference in the hormones that are ranging through the system, and whether you're predominantly spiking your cortisol or keeping it at the levels that are good for maintenance. And it makes a huge difference. So that's something I'd encourage you to work with people. And finally, the power of appreciation. And we go over that a lot with the heart math techniques and the breathing, but just walking from room to room and finding things to appreciate, just always looking for something to appreciate, right? Even in the bad stuff. I can look back at, like, when I was in my 20s and my health burned out. So grateful. I really am so grateful that happened to me when I was in my 20s, because I got so many extra decades of well-being as a result of that. Had I discovered fallen apart in my 40s or 50s instead. It might have been really far gone. It might have been even like my sister who her wake-up call was getting lymphoma, you know, or my brother-in-law whose wake-up call was getting lung cancer. And both of them are no longer with me. So what I think about is, wow, I was really fortunate. Because if I had continued on those same habits that I had when I was back in my 20s, I would not be what I am today. I would not be feeling full of life and energy and, you know, ideal body weight and able to exercise and able to stay up as late as I need to support other people. I would not be there. I would not be helping anybody had I continued on that. So I'm grateful for that. So what can you do and what can you teach people to do to look for those things to appreciate, especially kind of what they call the silver lining, right? You find the dark cloud and then look for the silver lining. It does wonders to transform their health and decrease the belly fat and just keep them energized. So the activities that we did in Module 3 was started out with reviewing goals and stress and sending people off to the 30-day stress transformation program. And if you haven't already signed up for that, sign up for it. Even if it's not something that you need, if you have your own stress reduction stuff that you do throughout the day, it's really valuable to have that as a resource for talking to people about, because it just makes all the difference in the world. And when you do it and you get in the habit of doing it, you don't find yourself freaking out when little things happen that you don't really want to happen. And then, of course, the goals. We talked about why that was important on the last slide. The next activity was what we call the portable anchor system. And that's similar to what I just described, where the patient took an index card. And for her, it was putting the choices she usually made and what she didn't want on one side of the card and what she did want and the other choice on the other side of the card, just as a reminder. After a while, she said she didn't have to pull the card out of her pocket. She'd keep it there and she'd just like put her hand over the pocket and she'd visualize what was on there and she'd make better choices. And she's just made better and better choices as a result. So that's a system that's in there that describes a lot of different ways that you can find to use sticky notes, use index cards, make collages, whatever it is to keep you anchored into your goal and the steps that you take to get there. Then there's the positive aspects journal. So it's actually taking people step by step through creating this positive aspects journal. Literally, it's a 5-minute-a-day thing. You can pick it up and you can just write a few things positive about yourself and read everything you've written so far. And it really just stokes your self-confidence. And it's a great thing to do with people who are really feeling beaten down because they've tried all different kinds of programs or they've had some tough things happen in their life and they just need a positive boost. And when they can generate it from out inside rather than having to just be other-derived reinforcement, that's when their true healing is going to start. Activity 4 is the emotional eating activity. It's the document that takes you through creating your own personal emotional eating strategy statement that you can carry around and fold up and keep it in your bag and take it out whenever you need it. Then there's an actual activity which makes people go through fun. What's fun? Make lists of it, organize it, figure out what they could do on days when they only have 5 minutes. What can they do on days, maybe the weekends when they have a little bit longer? But really harnessing the power of fun because it is incredibly healing. There have been whole books written about it. Laughter is the best medicine is one of them that comes to mind, about people healing themselves from cancer through watching funny movies and just having fun, laughing, smiling. It's hugely healing. And it's something that I like to incorporate in Module 3. Activity 6 is something called the emotional landscape. When I first saw this, it really hit home. It was something that I got from HeartMath, but it was so similar to something I'd already been doing with people for years, and it just gave it kind of a real nice structure. And it has to do with what your emotions, how your emotions trigger your adrenals and your immune system and your enzyme systems in your body. I'll show you that chart in a second. And it's a great one to use, especially if you work one-on-one across the table from people, is you can just pick out a piece of paper or pick out a blank, have some blanks in it, or just have them take a piece of paper and draw a T on it and start to work on that. It's really valuable activity. And then in each of our modules, we have a key like stress is the theme of module 3, but there's other little things that people can do to add on to the fitness, nutrition, sleep, and timing activities. When you're working one-on-one with somebody, you can be adding these extra things when you feel they're ready. But as a group, we put it out there and tell people, you know, when you're ready to add in the extra things, if you already mastered things, then you can move on to some of these other things. And that's all in the slide presentation from last week's call. So this is the emotional landscape, and it's broken into four quadrants, and on the left-hand side is the negative emotions, and on the right-hand side are the positive emotions. And at the top is high energy, and high energy triggers adrenaline. And at the bottom is the lower energy, and the lower energy is more of the calming neurotransmitters like acetylcholine. And it's not like a black or white, you're either up or down, there's a continuum. Some emotions are mildly high and some of them are super high. You know, like exhilaration might be a very high energy positive emotion, and joy might be a slightly high, and meditate, calm and serene would probably be a really low energy, and calm is down there as well. So just figuring out what emotions you usually experience, or your client is usually experiencing, and where that puts them, and what kind of hormonal neurotransmitter imbalances might their predominance in a certain area predispose them to. So when you look at this, the negative emotions generally also relate to cortisol. So across on the negative side, you're getting more cortisol coming out. When the negative emotions dissipate and you move towards the positive side, then you have more of a dominance of DHEA, which is healing and growth and repair. So this is a great little exercise you can do and sit across from people as you explain to them what the effects of their emotions are on how their body's doing. So that's it for Module 3. Let's move into Module 4. We just had the call for Module 4 2 days ago, and we're still kind of drip feeding the materials out with Module 4. You guys might get more into the Module 4 materials than the people that are not practitioners, just because there's just a lot of information, and I'm working on a reference sheet. I reference a lot of articles, and it's not as easy to just go and put the references in there. You got to format them and all that kind of stuff. So I'm in the process of copying and pasting from the reference articles that I talk about into a document, and that should be available within the next couple of days. So what are the highlights? Well, sleep is the theme, the lifestyle theme of the week for Module 4, and how apropos that we should talk about sleep deprivation, and I've had so much work this week that I've been getting back into sleep deprivation mode. And as I'm writing a talk on sleep deprivation, it's, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning, which seems kind of ironic, but it's the way it is right now this week. But basically, how does sleep deprivation affect you? How does it affect your hormones? How does it affect your mental function, your blood sugar metabolism, your energy, and your weight? And also, how does sleep deprivation affect your exposure, your risk factors for other things like cancers and heart disease and high blood pressure and diabetes? So we talk a lot about adopting a bedtime ritual to get people into sound sleep. And there's different activities, and it's all described in the module about turning the lights down and having a warm bath and things like that. And then there's a list of herbs and supplements. And that's where you can really be helpful with people, is really understanding how the different herbs and supplements would work and when some of those might be appropriate, if that's something that's within your scope of practice to do, is to supplement with people and recommend supplements for people. And then this piece, I just released the module on it this afternoon, is how to understand your own sleep cycle and choose a bedtime that optimizes the amount of deep sleep you get. And I want to spend a little bit of time on this because it's a really important piece. And so many times we hear you have to get 8 hours of sleep, you need 10 hours of sleep, you need a certain number of hours of sleep, when in reality you need a certain amount of deep sleep. And if you can optimize the amount of deep sleep you get, and you can make sure that you get a certain number of complete sleep cycles and not partial sleep cycles, you actually may not need the 7 or 8 hours of sleep. Maybe you can get by on 6 or 5.5, depending on the length of your sleep cycle. So the document, this PDF document I put out today, that talks a whole lot about the different sleep cycles and going from light sleep all the way down into deep sleep, and then REM sleep, which is rapid eye movement, dream sleep, basically, and how the pattern usually repeats itself several times throughout the night, and the length of the sleep cycle on average is about 90 minutes. Yours might be 120 minutes. It might be 70 minutes. Anywhere from 60 to 120 are common, but it's mostly right there in the middle at 90. So in the document, I teach people how to chart their sleep over the course of a week, just to get a sense of how many hours they're sleeping and how restful it is. And then to take weekend days, a couple of weekend days, and then go to bed at your regular bedtime, but don't set an alarm. Darken the room, make sure the dog is taken care of by someone else, and if you have a baby, see if your spouse can take care of the baby, and if you've got a telephone in the room, make sure the ringer is turned off, make sure your cell phone's out of the room, just make sure there's nothing that's going to prematurely startle you out of sleep. If you sleep in a bright room, if there's no blinders on it and bright light wakes you up, you might get a little one of those shade things for your eyes to put over it. Or one of the people in the program wrote back on the forum. She said, well, she doesn't like those things around her eyes, those masks, the sleep masks. But what she does is she just got some cheap cardboard, from boxes, and stuck those in the windows to cover up the light when she knows she has an opportunity to sleep past dawn. So there's a lot of ways to do it. And then you just watch until you wait until you wake up and get an idea of what your sleep cycle pattern would be, because your body will not, the brain will not wake you up from sleep. Unless you're at the end of a sleep cycle, unless something else wakes you, a loud noise or pain or a cortisol surge or something external. So you get a sense of how long, where you are in that sleep cycle, when you'll be at the end of the sleep cycle when you naturally wake up. A lot of the problems people get into is that they wake up and they go, oh, I can sleep another half hour, let me go back to sleep. And when you go back to sleep, you wake up more groggy than you had before, assuming you didn't get another full sleep cycle in. So if you find yourself just waking up naturally before the alarm and looking at the alarm and saying, well, I don't have to be up for another half hour, and then going back to sleep, you might consider adjusting your bedtime on the other end to be going to bed a half an hour later or an hour earlier. It just depends. If you want to either cut that last sleep cycle, make that last sleep cycle end a little bit later and get the same number of sleep cycles, or you could choose to go bed a little bit earlier and actually include an additional sleep cycle. And then as you play with this and chart it and figure it out, you can over time start to optimize. Once you really get settled in a good up and down time, so you're naturally waking at the time that's the end of the sleep cycle, then you can start figuring out, well, do I really need 6 sleep cycles? Can I get away with 5? And then adjust your bedtime according to that, or your rising time, actually. So that's an important piece, and I just wanted to give a lot of information about that, because a lot of time, one of the most common causes of fatigue is actually sleep deprivation. It's not necessarily some sort of nutritional imbalance, all that plays into it, but sleep deprivation is actually one of the most common causes of being tired, and people are always looking for crazy, reasons. So the other thing in this module 4 is to really look at the hormones. If you were on the call on Tuesday night, I went into a lot of detail on the various hormones, and I have another document that's coming out that has even more, and it'll have references in there. But the hormones that happen that need to be orchestrated to help you sleep is pretty profound. There's a lot of them, and they need to be orchestrated properly, and so that's where the food rules and the timing rules and using meditation and stress and things to calm you down, using dimming the lights to help you get more melatonin, really important. So that was an important piece of module 4. And then really, what are those pieces that you need to do so that your hormones aren't fighting at night? If you go to bed with food in your stomach, insulin comes out to try to get rid of the food, but then growth hormone won't come out because you won't get that nice surge in growth hormone that triggers fat burning and that triggers a lot of the repair. So it's a lot of those little things that, and we'll talk about a lot more next week in the timing module. So the activities in module 4. I've created a video that has, it's basically helping you get a good night's sleep, like really engaging all the resources that you have to help you get a good night's sleep. And it's an overview, it's about 10 minutes long. And then there's herbs and supplements, and that's where when you're working with people specifically one-on-one or even in a small group, you can help people to hone in on what are the herbs that would be helpful for them if they're having any sleep difficulties. If you're not having sleep difficulties, then we don't really have to look at that. The third activity, which is the one we released today, was how to maximize your deep sleep time by learning and understanding your sleep cycles and how to optimize those sleep cycles. We talked a bunch of that on the last slide. And then I've got a video, which that we're actually reversing activity 4 and 5 will probably be reversed because I'm not quite finished with the video. But the other piece is, and not activity 5, or actually will be 4, is the resource list, but also it's a lot more than a resource list. It's a list, and it goes through each of the hormones and with a lot of detail about them, and you know, references to some studies and all. And then there'll be the hormone dance video. And then there's just a few additional little activities that didn't quite fit in terms of being your own activity, so we put them into one place, and just kind of a list. And then again, the lifestyle always fits activity 7, and every module is going to be about the additional lifestyle activities that people can do to move themselves forward. The reason we did it this way, like activities, was that it just gave people something to do, so a guidance, letting people know what's there. Last time we did the program, we just put all the resources out there, and people would just get, oh, the module's open, and it's like a kid in a candy store. Which should I do first, and how should I do this? So we decided to do it this way, and actually send an email reminder like, okay, check out this activity, so that everybody brought to your awareness what's next and what you could be doing. So some of these pieces, if you're working one-on-one with people, you will be doing, and in other pieces you won't be doing, because it just isn't, it's not necessary to do it when you're working one-on-one, some of the group activities and all. So these are the hormones, and I have them mostly in pairs because there's the plus and the minus of the various ones. And if you want more details about those hormones, if you haven't already watched the module 4 video from the presentation on Tuesday, watch that. I go into a lot of detail there, and then I'm going to be putting out another one document tomorrow that will go into more details on those if you prefer to read. And of course, you will be getting transcripts for all the modules. I wanted to show you this because this is just, you know, I geek out on pictures like this, but pictures are worth a lot. And when people see the cyclical nature of the various hormones, so this is a particular one that I found for insulin and glucagon and how they need to be imbalanced. And if one is higher than the other, you're either going to get hypoglycemia or hyperglycemia. So folks, that a lot of people think that if you go a long period of time, naturally your blood sugar should drop. And yeah, it should, but it shouldn't drop into a state that compromises you. Maybe it's in the 70s if you haven't eaten for 8 hours versus in the 80s or in the low 90s or something if you've eaten within a short period of time. But it's basically the triggers are physiologically what's happening in your body. So when your blood glucose gets low, before you trigger an emergency response with cortisol, the natural response is the pancreas picks up on, oh, the blood sugar is low. Oh, let me get some glucagon out there. So the glucagon gets out there, goes to the liver, pulls out some of the stored glycogen. It also can go to the fat cells and pull some of that out. But mostly it goes to the liver, pulls out some glycogen, because really doesn't usually need that much, raises the blood sugar, and then everything's great. If glucagon is over secreted, then it's going to raise the blood sugar too much, which then is going to trigger a release of insulin to bring it back down. And then if you over-secrete the insulin, it's going to cause the blood sugar to go too low and then over-secrete glucagon. So you can have, if your pancreas tends to be hyperactive, you just have this constant yo-yo all day long, up, down, up, down, up, down, insulin, glucagon, insulin, glucagon. But when they're working in concert, you end up with normal blood sugar. And one of the things, when people are testing their blood sugar, this comes up all the time, they test and we'll find some spurious results. And what you need to know is your blood sugar is constantly going up and being brought back down, going low and being brought back up. And every now and then, when you test, you catch one of these right before the insulin came in and pulled it down, or right before the glucagon came in and pulled it up. And so you might see some oddball numbers. For example, I hadn't eaten much all day. Actually, I hadn't eaten anything. I just had some water. And it was about 3:30 or so, and I tested my blood sugar, and it went 56. I do not feel like my blood sugar is 56. You know what? 56, you're going to be feeling woozy and lightheaded and kind of faint, and I just felt hungry, really. I didn't feel odd. I'd just come off of like 6 in a row calls plus a radio show this morning, so my brain was working. I was working, but my blood sugar said 56, and I thought, that's odd. So I just did it right again another time right after that, and it was 76, and then I did it again, and it was 76, 78. So I realized that was just a spurious result. It could have been a machine error, or it could have been that I just caught it when it was dropping down and glucagon came in like it's supposed to and brought it right back up, and then I was back in the normal range. That can happen on the other end too. People say, well, I was going along, everything was good, and all of a sudden my blood sugar shot up to 170. And if it does that out of range, you go, huh, it's not even within that first hour. Why'd my blood sugar go up so high? Take it again immediately. And if you do, and it's just normal, and you do it a couple of times after that, and it's back into where you would expect it, then you know that was either a machine malfunction, or it was sugar had gone up for whatever reason, and then the insulin came in and got it back down, and you just happened to catch it in that way. So when we're looking at, brings up a lot of information about when we're looking at these glucose charts and trying to help people to balance them, is you have to look at the overall. If a spurious result here or there, you need to go back and recheck it, because it may not mean anything. It's the pattern overall of what we're looking for. And the other thing that comes up a lot is, I've been doing this for a week and my blood sugar is still high and I'm not feeling much energy. And that, yes, some people get the miraculous results immediately first day, everything's hunky-dory, but it takes a while for your body to adjust to any changes, any lifestyle changes, any diet changes, and to kick into new mechanisms. And the same way your broken arm is not going to heal within minutes or days of putting a cast on it, your broken insulin receptors are not going to be repaired within, you know, a few days or a week of doing the right things to calm and rest them. It needs longer. You will see subtle signs of it changing. People say, wow, the glucose is coming into balance. Our diabetic woman who went from, you know, in the 300 to 400 range down to in the low to mid 100s and dropped her medication, she's having significant change. And what I find with people is the worse off they are, the more significant the change usually is right up front. And the more fine-tuned someone is, the harder it is to get the change. And it has to do with kind of the 80-20 rule, right? It takes 20% of the effort to get 80% of the results, and then 80% of the effort to get the last 20%. So if you have people coming in to see you who've been working on their health and they're eating really well and they've been this, and there's only a few little things left for you to work on, the results are going to be a lot slower than the person who comes in that's eating McDonald's one day, and then you tell them to, you know, go gluten-free and go get off the carbs, the refined carbs, and get on whole foods, and they're willing to do it. Within 3 or 4 days, those people think you're a miracle worker, because it just is really profound the further along you are. But everybody's a little bit different, so we can't expect results to happen overnight. I wanted to share this chart with you and go into a little bit more detail than I did. I don't know if I did this on the call the other night or not, but it's on the slide presentation. Is the whole way that leptin normally works. And leptin, as you may remember, is the hormone that gets secreted by your fat cells. And it gets secreted when the fat cells are full. So once the fat cells get filled up after a meal and insulin stores fat away, they go, enough. And the leptin comes in and causes your appetite to go down and go away. And it also stimulates the pancreas to stop secreting insulin. But it also has a circadian rhythm, similar to cortisol. There's certain things that cortisol responds to, but cortisol has also got a circadian rhythm. So this is the normal leptin rhythm. And right at the end, this last one, 8 a.m. is where the early part of the day, that's when leptin is at its lowest And if you eat well throughout the day and you don't eat a high carbohydrate breakfast, you'll find that as the day progresses, you can go backwards on here and I can go forwards. Actually, it goes the other way. As the day progresses, it goes up again. It's a little confusing. They don't have the connection between 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. So this is basically, if you go in the other direction, you'd see the same thing, that the leptin starts to go up, and then, actually, no, it stays pretty level. That's why they don't do it. It stays pretty level until 6, and then at 6, it starts to go up. So the level at 8 a.m., the only spikes you get during the day from leptin is after eating, and then you get the leptin going up in response to eating. But otherwise, the baseline throughout the day is low. But if you eat a high carbohydrate meal early in the day, it's going to cause the leptin peak, which normally happens right at midnight, to actually happen sooner. And you'll see as leptin is rising, then you don't get hungry. So normally, from 6 p.m. up until midnight, you're not going to be hungry because you've got your leptin levels proper. But most people will eat those carbs too early in the day. What's the typical breakfast? Toast and bagels and croissants and cereal. And that affects the leptin levels and causes a premature peak, which will cause that hunger after eating. So it's really important when you're working with people is just to get them to stop eating those high-carb breakfasts and really focus on green breakfasts, protein-rich breakfasts. And I don't mean necessarily steak and eggs or bacon and eggs. I mean things that are rich in nutrition and have good amounts of amino acids. And I think green breakfasts are the way to go. I have a personal bias towards eating green in the morning because it sets the stage for the day, gives you lots of nutrients, doesn't upset the hormone balance, and provides a fair amount of protein, especially when you put some chia with it or some nuts or seeds or coconut or things like that. So the fat burning actually begins right, and it peaks. So the fat burning is at a certain level at midnight, and then it gets high all the way to 6, and then it starts to go back down again. But what happens when you have a leptin resistance, or you've eaten food early in the day? Well, then at 6 p.m., the leptin is a lot higher, and the signal that the food has been eaten isn't received by the hypothalamus, and the appetite doesn't get turned off. So here you're getting, it's high levels of leptin, but because it's so high, it's caused resistance, and you don't get this signal that says, stop eating, so you have intense cravings, especially for carbohydrates. So it peaks too early, right before you even go to bed, and that's like the midnight snack, the nighttime heebie-jeebies really want that food, and then comes on down. And then you only get a little bit of fat burning when it gets down low enough at 4 a.m. So you really minimize your fat burning. I wanted to touch on normal fasting blood sugar because we're going to be looking at a few cases. And I wanted you to understand where this is coming from so when we go through the pictures. I think the ideal is, well, the normal lab range is 80 to 99. That's what's considered normal. Actually, I think they say 65 to 99. A really good healthy range to strive for is below 80s. But a lot of people are going to be in the 90s to start out with, and sometimes it goes up before it goes back down. And some of that has to do with the low carbohydrate intake. The lower carbohydrate intake is actually causing you to have more of the glucagon or cortisol being secreted to try to get their blood sugar and keep it at a steady pace. After a while, that gets normalized. And it goes back down to where it was. That happened to me for a while. I was like, wait a minute, I've always had perfect fasting blood sugar. Why am I waking up with a fasting blood sugar in the 90s? 95, 98, a couple of times? That doesn't make any sense. And as I went through the process and helped to restore some of my sensitivity, I found that I'm consistently in the high 70s to low 80s every morning. It's without fail. So it just normalizes over time, and sometimes it takes longer. Some studies suggest that in the mid-90s ranges predicts that the person's going to have diabetes a decade later. So the standard medical way to look at it is that anything from 100 to 119 is considered pre-diabetes or insulin resistance. and anything 120 or over is diabetes. But really, when they did longitudinal studies and followed people out, people that had mid-90 range fasting blood sugars over time had a higher incidence of diabetes a whole decade later. But wow, wouldn't you like to be able to do things that change how you're going to be a decade from now, that prevent a disease a decade from now? I think that's pretty amazing. And then I shared with you last week some of the studies that said any above 90 fasting glucose increases your risk of cardiovascular disease. And any numbers that go above 120 increase the diabetic complication type conditions like the neuropathies and the retinopathies and damage to the small vessels and the small nerves. Okay, and we're going to keep that handy for when we go and look at our cases. I brought that in because we're going to be doing some cases. So as a reminder, this was a test where people were given a low carbohydrate breakfast right at the beginning. I think they were given it right here. Was it 7:30? Yes, 7:30, 6:30, 7:30. Right here they were given their breakfast. And then they watched as their sugars went up. And you can see for most people, it peaked about 45 minutes later. And these are the ranges that they found. At the low end, these people barely got to 100 and then came back down. And that was not an uncommon thing. That wasn't just a spurious one or two people. And what I encourage people to see is that it's not normal for the sugars to go up. One person had asked on the forum, like, but isn't it normal for the sugars to go up? Yes, they're supposed to go up, but then a nice balance brings them right back down again. They go up and they go back down again. They go up and they go back down again. And so the curve looks like, you know, you follow the insulin, it follows it up there. The insulin follows it almost exactly. Mm-hmm. And at the high end, those are people who are predisposed to diabetes soon thereafter. But even in the middle, it barely goes above 120. And this is for a general mixed population. So really want to be targeting for keeping it below 100 at all times. But it's realistically, they're not going to keep it there. So you have to make judgments. I say to people, okay, 110, just because I don't want them eating a food that consistently raises their blood sugar above that. But it may turn out to be that, like in the case of our diabetic person, she has to use different numbers. She has to use, well, oh, when I eat something I shouldn't, my sugar goes up to 300 again, but when I stay within this diet, my sugars stay in the low 100s. That's fine. So you have to meet people where they're at, especially if they have diabetes or have been really pre-diagnosed with insulin resistance. So let's review. I'm going to take a sip of water as my voice is getting tired out. All right. So just an overview of what we're doing. These rounds calls are intended to be interactive. Lots of cases. You guys can submit your cases. And I have cases that have been submitted by people in the program. I added one bonus coaching call. We'll probably have another one. I'll put out a little notice to see. You have to look at my schedule and look at everybody else's. Just in general, to get a show from people as to whether it's better to have those coaching calls, the bonus coaching calls, during the day, late afternoon, or into the evening like this. And then we have on the 21st our virtual seminar, and it's basically intended to be like we're all getting into a room and learning this stuff. And you're going to walk away with an outline for a program that you can offer, including how much you're going to cost, how long is it going to be, and how many people you're going to get signed up for it if you're already in practice and want to make that commitment. So we'll give you the opportunity to really commit and be held accountable to your partners and to me with moving forward and making it something that you can offer people. When you just go out there and say, I do health coaching or I do nutrition coaching, people are going, yeah, you know, there's a lot of people that do that. And if you happen to be talking to somebody and they're talking about their sugars or they have belly fat problems or whatever you do to talk to people when you're out and about what you do, and you say, oh, well, I do health coaching and I have this special program where I take people through to help balance your blood sugars and get rid of belly fat and clear your brain, and, you know, would you like to hear more about that? So you can have something that you've already put together and you know what it's going to be, how much it's going to cost, and you can offer that to people, and you can actually start recouping your investment in this in like one person. So the Saturday intensive training, I'm going to go into a little bit more on the review plus additional information and background on the physiology and biochemistry of the blood sugar metabolism and how to optimize it. So some of that will be reviews, some of that will be just going into a little bit more depth. Then I'm going to teach you how to teach and monitor at-home blood glucose testing. And this is going to be an interactive day, and there'll be breakout sessions where we'll break you into groups, and one person will be the client and one person will be the practitioner. And you're going to explain to somebody about their blood results or about how to do their blood glucose, and you can give each other feedback. And maybe we'll do, if we have enough people on the call, we'll do three groups of three, where one's the observer, one's the client, and one's the practitioner, and then switch around so everybody gets an opportunity to really practice it. Because it makes a huge difference when you're practicing it in front of somebody versus just writing it down on paper. I want to go into much more detail about the labs and how you can get order them, how you as practitioners can order them, what companies will allow you to set up an account. And I know those of you who have licenses like DCs and acupuncturists and MDs and physician's assistants, you can just naturally get access to those labs, but there are ways for others to get access to those specialty tests that you can do in order to help people to get through this and also go through how to read them, you know, how to explain it to people. And then basically setting up insulin resistance programs for your clients. How do you do it? How do you motivate them? How do you inspire them to stick with the program? Because it isn't easy, and people get discouraged. And we hear that a lot on the forum where people are feeling overwhelmed, and then we have other people chiming in and supporting them. So there's a lot there to be said. So that's it for our formal presentation for the evening.
112 over 70-something. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever, before this week, I don't think I've ever had a blood pressure reading higher than 120 over 80. Today, it hit 146 over 91.
Wow.
Yeah, interesting stuff going
this
on.
This is, yeah.
I think I have figured out what's going on. I don't know if you want to get into that now, but...
Well, I would like to know. I think it would be helpful if you think it would be helpful for other people to hear. Yeah.
Yeah, I actually do. And to sort of summarize, you know, when I submitted my chart, I said I had kind of a wild ride. I took my blood pressure reading because I was just feeling really weird. And I don't know, just, you know, we've got a cuff and it's handy, and so what the heck, I was trying to figure out what was going on because the blood sugar was stable, so I knew that wasn't it. And I had all of these ups and downs with blood sugar, and sometimes heart math would make it drop 30 points, sometimes heart math made it go up. I mean, it was, I say made it, it seemed to correlate. It was weird, and then with today's blood pressure readings, and I just felt pressured inside. Not good. And then it hit me.
See if you can move your microphone a little further away from your mouth. It sounds like there's a little extra.
I don't think it's on. I don't think that's on my line.
Oh, maybe somebody else is open. Let me look to see if somebody else is open. Maybe I forgot to shut Beverly down. Yeah. She had a lot of construction going on. Right. Okay, go for it.
Okay. So this morning it hit me, and I think the answer is in Chinese medicine. And it is, this is spring, this season of the liver. And blood sugar, blood pressure spikes are, in Chinese medicine, a symptom of liver wind. Long story short, kind of... basically deficient yin going in a certain direction. And so then I get thinking about, all right, what aggravates liver wind? Top of the list, eggs. So I've been having eggs for breakfast, an egg. And it's a, you know, it's a pastured, high-quality egg, yada, yada. But I did that because, I mean, obviously eggs aren't on your program. But my normal breakfast is soaked steel-cut oats with coconut and blueberries and walnuts and goat milk. And obviously that's out for this program. And I had such a negative reaction to the protein powder, but I know I need, and I tried breakfast of just, you know, like the chia puddings, and it was just not enough for me. So I figured, all right, I will have an egg. Spring's kind of, you know, eggs would be normal in nature. And I think that's it. The other things that kind of add to this are avocado and relying too much on nuts. And I have to say, I mean, if you read down through my diet, I've been eating a lot of avocados and a lot of nuts and this egg every morning. And I have to say, without this food diary, I don't think I would have gotten this connection, which is yet untested, because I didn't realize all of this until after this morning's egg, and I didn't have an avocado today, but egg breakfast. But I believe that's what's going on for me. Now, I think it's also very unlikely that maybe any of us will ever run into this in a participant in an insulin resistance program, because to me, fundamentally, insulin resistance, you know, it often involves excess weight, and these are symptoms of excess. And I tend to have more symptoms of deficiency. So, you know, your protocol and the raw food and everything is superb for a person with excess issues, and it's going great for my husband. Mm. And what I am running into is, you know, this is now twice, 3 years ago with the total raw food diet, and now with this program, I adopt dietary protocols that are right for him because we're addressing his health issues, and I throw myself out of whack. So
do you think it's just the egg-avocado fat connection, or do you get thrown off by the coldness of the food?
I'm not eating a lot of raw food, but I think also, I think I'm getting too much heat from the egg and too much drying from the nuts, and cutting the other way. I think the constipation that I've been experiencing that was just, I couldn't figure it out. It's not, I mean, I used to have two or three bowel movements regular every day. And then I went into this program, which wasn't a huge change in my diet. And bam, I get constipated, and I could not figure out why. And I think it's that coconut oil, for one thing. I'm going to switch to coconut cream.
Mm-hmm.
Coconut oil is really cool. And I've been relying a lot on green powders, and they have a lot of microalgae in it, and microalgae is very cold. So I suspect I've been doing, sort of hitting myself both ways. And then just the variability that's showing up in my chart, variability is also a symptom of liver wind, which to me kind of, provisionally at this point, validated what I think I have going on. And I'll keep you all posted.
Yeah, please do. And I'd like to know, how can we modify this for you to make it work, to keep it with obviously the low sugars, because you did have those spikes, so the low-carb sugar stuff and other foods that would balance you from a Chinese medicine perspective?
Well, I am going to be working on that. I mean, I am working on that now. We'll figure that out. I may temporarily, I may test an oatmeal breakfast in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really expect that to, be low blood sugar. But right now, I want to get my blood pressure back down and then figure out the other things. And the closest thing I have to a craving is for something like, I told my husband the other day, I said, I want an orange vegetable. Doesn't have to be a sweet potato, but, you know, there's a butternut squash in my pantry that I've got my eye on. And I may try some of that at any rate.
Try it with a bunch of, like, greens, and it sounds some steamed greens or whatever, just to give and see how it goes.
Absolutely. I mean, that's kind of the way I normally eat them anyway.
But this is great.
I am going to be working on that. You know, what is the cooked food, low glycemic version of this? Breakfast is my challenge.
Yeah.
I'll figure out something. And again, I'll let you know. But when I figure this out, it's obviously going to be a very different, sort of a parallel program for a different metabolic type.
Mm-hmm.
One more thing, something you said that, I hope I can capture. There was something else I wanted to say about this. Now, if I think of it, I will raise my hand. But
yeah, you know what I wanted to comment on is just this brings up how different we all are and how many different considerations there are to keep in balance, right? The typical insulin resistance diet, if you were to buy like the insulin resistance solution or the insulin resistance diet book or anything that's out there, they rely heavily on animal protein. And you want to talk about a constipating diet if you're having bacon and eggs for breakfast and steak for lunch and burgers for dinner, as long as you don't have the bun, that's a pretty constipating diet. So everybody's a little bit different. So it's finding what's going to work for you, but keep your blood pressure balanced, keep your blood sugar balanced, and keep you eating, the very nutrient-dense foods as well. So
exactly. I thought of the other thing I was going to say.
Yes.
My sense of this is that my insulin resistance issue, which I clearly do have, and by the way, would never have known had we not adopted this program to address my husband's insulin resistance issue, I think it is perhaps virtually 100% stress-related. And, I have been going through the stress. I just signed up for the emails today because, frankly, I didn't want another email in my inbox. But the answer is not to leave out the stress reduction emails, is to get rid of some of the other stuff. and this work is that there's other things, practices and things that I'm already doing to try and address some of these. Reintroducing myself to the HeartMath gizmo, I can get addicted to that thing. It's just wonderful. And I love, it's just a good opportunity to tell you that the unique things that I see in this program, among the unique things, and hugely valuable to me, is the stress, the little sort of anti-stress bites here and there, and the exercise bursts, which I think is brilliant. And it really is, I've struggled with, how can I get enough exercise, practical into my day? And those, it's just so easy, and it makes a big difference. And I love that you just popped my eyes wide open on the sleep analysis and the bit about the cycles. It's one night I did that. I just sort of noticed anytime I woke up, I looked at the clock and I the time I went to bed and the time I woke up naturally the next morning and everything. And it was, I have a 90-minute sleep cycle and I got 5 cycles that night. It was just very, very revelatory. And very cool and fascinating, and I thank you for that.
Oh, you're so welcome, and I appreciate your comments, and I just know that, so many people have this hidden insulin resistance, and whether or not, it's not obviously wasn't caused by your food. My insulin resistance was not caused by my food. My food was impeccable. It wasn't caused by my exercise, but the sleep was way out of whack, and it creates the insulin resistance and just makes you have to be so much more careful with the food, so that you don't get the complications of it, right? I don't want my blood vessels stiffening up, and I don't want my blood pressure going up and all that just because I'm not sleeping. That makes no sense. So controlling the food while you reverse the insulin resistance is important. But for you, like for your husband, it may be important for him to just always be on the low glycemic diet. You may get your stress under control and be able to eat the higher glycemic whole foods, not the crap that most
people eat,
right? But the whole foods, like the butternut squashes and the fruits and the sweeter fruits and all that, which are healthy foods. They're not bad foods. It's just when you're in this state, they exacerbate the rest of it. So it's interesting to see, and thank you for sharing this because it's very eye-opening. And, maybe we'll have you come back the next time we do this program and have a little talk on looking at the Chinese medicine approaches for, you know, if things are going wrong, what it might be.
Love that.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You know, the thing about sleep I wanted to mention is that so freeing is that when you think about the cycles versus the number of hours, you say, oh, my God, I have to get 8 hours and I can't get 8 hours. But you look at the clock and you go, well, if I go to bed now, I'm going to get 5.5 sleep cycles. If I stay up another 45 minutes and then go to bed, I'll get 5. And in both cases, I'm going to have the same benefits on my body because that extra half cycle isn't going to do me any good. And I'm going to wake up refreshed in the morning rather than in the middle of a cycle and feeling groggy. So it puts us in control of how we wake up in the morning and gives us the flexibility to when things we're going later than we expect to be going, that we can free ourselves up and say, okay, look, if I can't go to bed now, I have another hour. I have another hour and 15 minutes, you know, to hang out and do my thing. And I don't encourage that on a regular basis, but it certainly gives you that empowerment as well. So I encourage you to read the document that I put out there on that. Beatrice has another question, and I'm opening up your mic. Okay, go ahead, Beatrice.
Hey, here I am, Dr. Rita Marie. It's not a question. It's something that happened to me, and I thought it might be something that people should know. As you know, I've been staying away from all soy and all dairy since, September of last year.
Mm-hmm.
But I was invited to a Mexican restaurant, and I thought I could have a chile relleno, which is comfort food for me.
What is that?
A green pepper stuffed with the cheese.
Mm.
Thought that eating cheese once after so many months would not be that bad.
Mm.
Usually the stuffed chile poblanos are battered in with flour and egg, and I didn't have that. I just had the plain chile poblano with the cheese. I found out afterwards, the next day, because I was feeling so very sick and exhausted, that what I had was not really cheese, even though this is an excellent restaurant and they always had very good food. The cheese was an imitation cheese. An imitation cheese is made with soy and with potato and with gluten.
Oh, my goodness.
So I got a bad whammy. It never occurred to me, because I had been there months before, and they had given us very good cheese, that they might have changed the cheese. Never occurred to me to ask if it was imitation cheese. I don't think they would have answered the truth anyway. But people should know there's a lot of imitation cheese out, and if you're trying to stay away from soy or from gluten, it's made out of that.
And, you know, the interesting about those imitation cheeses, a lot of the non-dairy cheeses, they actually have casein in them. They have sodium caseinate to make them sticky. So even though they're non-dairy in the bulk of it, they're still not non-dairy. And when you're sensitive, just a little bit is all it takes. So, you know, especially with gluten or soy, and you don't know, you might have been had the same reaction if you had the dairy one too, because you may have reacted that way to the dairy as well. But
if it had been really good cheese, I would have really enjoyed it. But I was so sick the next day. I was too sick to test my blood when I came home. I felt that bad, and I thought it was because it was too heavy. But the next day, I realized it wasn't that, and my husband found out. My husband used to have a pizzeria when we lived in Texas, and he said he was offered that imitation cheese all the time, and he never used it because he said it wasn't real cheese. So he found out what it is that I had eaten. He was laughing. He said, you stay away from soy sauce, and then you have this thing.
And then, wow.
So,
well, you live and you learn, right? Now you know.
Live and learn, and it's something that I hadn't heard anyone mention, so it's something to be aware about.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll mention that, you know, as a reinforcement is just the processed, anything that's a processed food. And when you eat in a restaurant, you really, really, really have to ask questions.
Well, it's getting to the point where I really don't want to go out to restaurants. And I used to take my own salad dressing and have just lettuce and add my own salad dressing to it.
Yeah.
And even then, as I was talking to my husband, he said, do you know that restaurants buy the salad already chopped up, the lettuce chopped up, and it's full of sulfites so it won't go bad and other chemicals? So
yeah,
to be aware whether it's worth it or not.
I know. It just takes the fun out of it, but, boy, it puts the fun back in when you have your energy and your body back. So it's just this trade-off, right, the double-edged sword.
I said, no matter how much I like chiles rellenos, they're going to be off unless I make them myself.
Yeah.
And which I don't plan to right now because it really, I mean, the experience was so bad.
Yeah.
I really did.
Well, you know, I've made chile rellenos where you cut them open and you stuff it with, I think there's even there might be a recipe in the Before We Gone book where you make like a cashew or a macadamia or some kind of nut or seed cheese. And you put that in the middle and stuff it and, you know, spice it and all that. And it's really yummy. In fact, one of the restaurants here, we have a raw foods cafe called Beets. And they periodically have these things. They're little jalapenos. It's similar to chile relleno, where it's a little tiny jalapeno pepper that they stuff with the cheese. And then they have almonds that have been dehydrated, and they grind them up as it looks like a breading on the top.
I'm going to try one of those. Yeah.
You should give that a try because, you know, that way it satisfies that longing. Like someone said, you know, the pizza, when I smell the pizza. Well, there's ways to make the pizza that actually taste better and are much better for you. It's just a matter of learning the techniques, learning how to make a crust made with you know, flax and chia and vegetables and almonds instead of the flour. And then using the cheeses, you've got lots of recipes in the Before We Gone book. And then it's homemade marinara sauce and lots of veggies. And people love my pizzas, and they don't even realize they're raw.
They're raw. And for me, it certainly was not worth it. All that, you know, the soy that I ate and that gluten and everything, it made me sick.
Yeah, so now you're not going to want to do it. It really, sometimes we need to have those experiences. I swore off wine back, 26 years ago. When I had been off of it for a year because somebody told me I had candida, and I said, okay, I'll try going off all alcohol, and I had been off of it. And it was New Year's Eve, and my husband had a bottle of red wine, and we were just celebrating being together because we were newly together, and it was New Year's Eve, and I said, oh, I'll have a glass of wine. And I think I had one half of a glass of wine, and I spent the next 3 days in bed.
Yeah.
And I have never, ever been tempted by alcohol, ever since, ever.
Right.
So it's those negative experiences that help us to learn what our body likes and what our body doesn't so we can make those choices, you know. And as you're working with people, as you're working with clients, there's going to be a lot of baggage. Well, I don't want to give up this and I don't want to do that. And it's bargaining, like, okay, give it up for this period of time. Let's just see how you do. And then allow them to have as much as they can eat over a three-day period. And if that's not good for them, they're going to feel really lousy, and then it's going to be such a better emphasis for them, such a better a life lesson than if you tell them versus they learn for themselves, right? If I were to say to you, Beatrice, be really careful going into restaurants. You may have, you know, you never know the difference, and don't be tempted by the chile rellenos. You may have heard me on that because you respect my opinion and all, but you may have said, you know, one little one is not
going
to hurt me.
Going
but
to
now
hurt.
You go, no, I'm not going to do it.
Why, no.
Yeah, well, okay. Good. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
So who else had a question? Beverly, did you have your hand up again, or did I just forget to put it down? Oops, you're not open yet. I can't get your mic open. Stretch my screen out. Okay.
It was to give you a little suggestion for Robin.
Yeah.
With her chart, she was surprised about her blood pressure. And my question would be, has she ever had constipation to this degree? And I used to see a correlation between constipation and the hypertension.
Mm-hmm.
and especially occasional readings. And I just wonder if that could be part of what's going on here with her, you know. And for Beatrice, there is that if she's interested in not in looking for a vegan cheese that she can buy and not have to make, which, by the way, those I love making my own nut cheese. It's so easy, and it smells so good. Oh, my God, especially if you put it in the dehydrator on kale. You swear you're making pizza in the house, but it's wonderful. But if you wanted to buy something, that cheese called Daiya, D-A-I-Y-A, has no gluten, and it's no casein. It's a really good substitute for something store-bought for people who want to be vegan, gluten-free, it's a nice, healthy alternative.
And check your blood sugars with it because it's rice-based.
Yes, and check your blood, of course,
as
with any new food, right?
Right. And know that it's processed and you're not going to want to do it a lot, but
it's an occasional
treat.
Exactly, right, if you get into a bind. And then the other question is, how do we gauge if your bedtimes are kind of crazy, like, as you know, depending on who's here? I can't even get into my kitchen and my bedroom right now.
That's a good question.
And you're all over the place. Is there a way to figure out, okay, tonight I'm just going to see what time it is when I go to bed, try to make sure my cat's been kind of, something's not quite right with him, and he's been waking me up now. We didn't have enough factors here, so trying to figure out how to do that test.
How to do that. Yeah, that's a good question, because for you, you're up and down, and you're driving 3 hours on some nights, and other nights you're home, and you're going to be going to bed at a different hour. But you need to just maybe even, you know, you're not going to get much information from that week-long thing to just estimate. So just go to bed at not what your regular bedtime would be, but what a desirable bedtime would be on the weekend. So get your butt into bed at 10 o'clock.
Right.
And then just make sure the blinds are down and nothing's going to wake you. There's no cat that's going to jump in and whatever. And then just see how long it takes to you to wake up. And that would give you a general idea. Yeah.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, it's really nice to know, because it's like, well, I've noticed this, and I've noticed this consistently. There's sometimes when I go to bed and I only have 3 hours to sleep because I've gone to bed too late, and I wake up and I feel fine.
I've had that happen to me when I was studying back in school. It would be weird. I'd be like, wait a minute, I only went to bed 2 or 3 hours ago, or whatever it would have been at that point, and or even an hour and a half. And I'm like, okay, maybe I am a 90-minute cycle.
Maybe you have a 90-minute. You just got that full cycle, because it really is groggy when you wake up off cycle. Especially if something wakes you up in the middle of stage four. Holy cow. You know, you're in there like, whoa. You don't feel very good, and it can actually throw you off for the whole day if the alarm beeps you in the middle of that cycle. So you're much better off figuring it out so that if you do need to put the alarm on just in case, right, if you have work to go to or whatever, then you go to bed in such a way that you know you're going to end up at the end of that cycle right before the alarm rings. So just in case you fall, you know, you don't wake up, it'll be there for you.
Right. You don't want to jolt yourself out of it, but
right.
You also need to be, you know, trying to make sure you don't oversleep too.
Yeah.
And what if you get, you know, and I'm thinking that maybe those couple of times that I told you I saw a 99, I posted about that, in the fasting, I bet you that's what happened, that they were usually on the weekend, and I, you know, will wake up, and some days I'm like, okay, well, I never just wake up and go, oh, my gosh, I feel great. But some days there's absolutely, like, even just opening your eyes feels like you're lifting 100,000 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder if that was, you know, one of the many times I get wakened by some other sounds, and
right, and then you don't get the full, you don't get enough. You really need to get about 2 hours. I think I mentioned that in the book, in the little, it's a book. I call it a book. It's 19 pages, so it's almost a book. But in that little PDF that I put out today, that I think I mentioned, you really, really need to get about 2 hours of the deep sleep. And some people talk about really optimizing so that you get just those 2 hours, but You can't get rid of the light sleep either. But yeah, and I described that in that handout. You can read all about that. I just give you a little summary if you've done sleep stuff. But yeah,
and the handout was in which place?
We sent an email out today that said go to the module 4 page, activity 3. Great questions. Robin, did you have anything you wanted to comment about that, you know, what you know if constipation can be, in your experience, related to?
Yeah.
If it could...
I did think of that, actually. I appreciate it. Was it Beverly?
Beverly.
Yeah, I appreciate Beverly mentioning that, suggesting that. I did think of that. So there have been a couple of times, whether for blood pressure or before my blood pressure spike, I've done several enemas in the past week just because, you know, I felt like, all right, this
mm-hmm.
is all about, I mean, there is a cleansing aspect to me
yeah.
of this program, and I didn't want the drain clogged. So, and the long story short, the enema did not budge the blood pressure.
Mm. So the enema only works, though, usually in the lower part of the colon. And if you've got constipation that is more of an entire colon issue, it may not have enough of an impact. It's not like getting a deeper colonic where you really get in there and really cleanse, unfortunately. It helps eliminate what's kind of there in the sigmoid, you know, area, and it gives you kind of like a feeling of relief from the release of that impaction at the end of the colon, but more of the buildup can cause an elevation in the blood in the blood pressure, and it may be if you are using or like any of the bigger, you know, colon cleanse type programs, it might behoove you to try maybe one of those or some herbs, because I know. Like Cleaver's herb, right, Dr. Rita Marie? There's some other as
Cleaver's
well.
Cleaver's is more of a lymphatic. I don't know about that as a...
I had a couple that loved that for that reason. I've never had that problem in so long because of my diet. I mean, being...
But there's a lot of
the
possibilities, Val.
There's
Senna and Cascara, which are really strong. And well, you're trained in Chinese medicine, so you may have some ideas about some of those other herbs. Health Force has a really good one that's really mild. It's
yeah.
not as jarring.
But I, today, I'm happy to say that the system seems to be running fine, but the blood pressure is still high. So I don't think it's, you know, system-wide.
Right.
Not, you know, not to argue with you, but I don't think that's what is going on here. But then all of this is a work in process. And
right. Right. Well, give it a couple of days as you shift the diet around and get the eggs out and see what happens.
And I'd also like, with that diet information, I had gone back to a little bit of meat in my diet years ago, probably about 4 or 5 years ago, for maybe a 6 month period, only eating very clean meat, humanely raised, humanely slaughtered, even very. If you could consider that, to me it's kind of an oxymoron, but I did think that my constipation, that's the last time I can remember having constipation. So if you can maybe do an experiment with eliminating animal products for a while and just looking for really great substitutes before you make the switch, so you're not stressed from, oh my God, what am I going to eat now? Because you don't want to do that either, because that's not good for the blood pressure. And maybe just see how your body reacts if you were to try eliminating the animal products from it. It's just a thought. My doctor wanted me to try to see how I would do, to see if it brought my energy level up. And if it made a huge difference for me, and it actually made me much worse. And in fact, I became 100% vegan after that. And at that point, I did see some marked improvement in all of the issues that I've been trying to clear up finally now. So it's just a thought. It's been my experience.
This, again, is, you know, we're getting the natural variation between individuals, because I was vegan for 2 years and then added, again, like you say, you know, the highest quality animal products I can find back into our diet. this, I don't know, a year ago, six, nine months, a year ago, something like that. So that change, that is not a change in our diet. For me to be, the eggs, you know, having eggs in the morning is different. You know, I've had maybe one egg a week, if that, for the past year. But in terms of, you know, having 3 ounces of chicken, 4 ounces of turkey meatloaf, a small piece of fish. That
are you gluten-free? Are you gluten-free? Because I'll tell you what.
I have been for about 9 months. I actually kind of stopped that right before this program. Although on this program I've been gluten-free because we're not eating grains, right?
Okay, great. So there's no gluten in the meatloaf.
No, actually, I didn't make it, but I read the ingredients list, and there was no gluten in the meatloaf.
Great. And no other types of grain?
No.
Yeah, the Cascara Sagrada, like you said, Rita Marie, might be, you know, a few of the other herbs or whatever, because there's nothing worse than that feeling. Gosh, constipation is the worst, isn't it?
It's not fun.
I can only remember.
I know,
there's
it's been so long.
There's been a lot of things in this week that have not been fun, but, you know, my view of it is, oh, this is all telling me something. And, again, I think today I figured out what it is that my body's been telling me, and I'll experiment with that for a few days. But, you know, I appreciate all of your comments, and if what I think is going on, it doesn't solve the problem. You know, there's some things I can try then.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah, thank you for doing and posting all that and showing us what's going on. And please get back and let us know.
Right.
Sure will.
Well, I have one more little case that I wanted to bring up. It's from Rebecca, and she added some stuff, so I just was scrolling through to see what she added because we went through. She said some things were happening. There's a 135 thing with sweet sauce that made her sugar go up to 135. So it's interesting how just little things can do it. Like here she had honey sincere, went to Passover dinner, only ate homemade, and then her blood sugars, we'll show you over here. No, I can't do it. Well, anyway, she ate this meat with fish with sweet sauce, and her sugar went up to 135, even though it had been pretty good up until then. What else? So her question was about her food. Her levels of sugars are fairly high most mornings, like 103. You could see them, 103. There's one she wanted me to look at. And then after she ate, it went down. She's
103
like,
to 89, huh?
Huh? Yeah. So 103, she eats lunch. She doesn't say exactly the time difference between them, but the lunch had beetroot, arugula, garbanzo beans, apple cider vinegar, olive oil, and cabbage. So a couple of things that could have caused a high. You would expect a high and then a low, but interesting that it brought it down. It's hard to really read because there's not a lot of data here. But there's something to think about. So when somebody eats and then it goes down, what could be going on? Well, here's another one. Haven't eaten, this went up, sorry. Some of this could be adjustment stuff, but when you see consistently that somebody is going and having, so various things that caused her to go up that she marked. If somebody starts with a certain blood sugar and then they eat something and it goes down, Michaeline brought that up last week in her chart, was that could be that you're having a big insulin surge and it's causing the sugar to go down. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you mask the elevation of the sugar itself. You don't see that if you're combining like carb with a lot of fat or a lot of protein. So for example, there was one study where they took people and they measured their glucose and insulin when they ate potatoes. And as expected, it went up high. Then they fed them the potatoes with meat, like a fatty kind of a meat, and they measured their glucose and insulin. Their glucose didn't go up, but their insulin did. So it's like as if the fat is slowing down the absorption of the sugar, but it's still triggering a high insulin response. And if you do that and you trigger a high insulin response, your insulin resistance, you're going to see a rapid falling. So that could be something, that something in the meal she's eating is causing the insulin to go up, but not the other. Now, if it's spuriously happening periodically, it could be stress. It could be she sat down to eat and the news was on and she was hearing in the background about a hurricane in some place, or she was on the phone talking to her mother who was getting her all upset about Aunt Sally's, you know, brain tumor or something. There's a lot of possibilities. And what we're looking for is not just single things, but patterns. What consistently? Oh, every time she ate something that had something sweet in it, boy, her sugars went up. That's just saying she's sensitive to the sweets. We got to do it. If occasionally her sugar jumps up after something that's not expected to jump it, well, let's just throw out that data. But when you're working with people, they're going to want an explanation for everything. And quite frankly, we don't have an explanation for everybody unless we're able to hook them up and get the kind of consistent glucose read. You know those meters? There's meters you can hook up to your body, and it'll just give you a constant readout of the glucose. Be nice to do that and be able to get a constant readout of the insulin like they can do in labs. And unfortunately, you can't see that, so we just only have to guess. And so the combinations that seem to raise insulin without raising the glucose that could give you a false sense of security are carbohydrates with fats and carbohydrates with proteins, like heavy-duty ones, so like the meat and potatoes kind of thing, you know, bread and sausage, bread and bacon, whatever, that kind of thing. Those kind of things can raise it up. Or even something like a raw foods dessert, which is got dates or agave or something like that, plus the fat in the nuts, those may be even triggering that kind of it doesn't make the sugar go up, but it makes the insulin go up. So we save these kinds of things for very special occasional treats. The one thing I want to make sure that you're aware of in doing your own and when you're working with people is just don't let people get stressed out about it. I had this number, it went up to 135. Okay, it went up there once, and everything else was normal. Let's just calm down and let it be. So these are kind of interesting to look at. If you guys have any of your own to submit, feel free to just go to this location here, the documents, and submit them on the Insulin Resistance Practitioner page rather than on the regular page, unless it's something you really want to share with everybody and you think it would be beneficial. But that's about it. So I don't have anything else planned for tonight. We can call it a night. And if you have any other questions, feel free. Michaeline has one. For it, Michaeline.
Yeah, I was just curious. In the recipe book, like in the beverage section, you have smoothies with high sugar fruits. And I wondered why that was in there. Is that for like a transition or?
It should not be in there at all. It's in the main recipe guide or is it in the beverage guide?
No, it's in the beverage guide.
Okay. That was transition. And it's she said that on the page when she put that up on the page. That was for people who were like just moving into this, never had a green smoothie before, getting them used to it. And I think we said it on the page that said these are not intended for use. You're going to have to test these during the program. Yeah.
Okay. That's what I was thinking, but I just wanted to check.
Yeah. We may have to just make sure that comment that was on the page is actually in the book as well. Remember, put on your calendar the 21st of April. I'll give you the exact times. It's April the 21st, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central, which would be 9 to 3 in the West, and then whatever it comes out to be in between. Okay, so put that on your calendar because it'll be great for you to have you on there. I want to make it really interactive. I want to make it really fun and really rewarding and have you guys walk away with information that you can put into place. All right, good night, everyone.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.